I mean, you can find 10 times more information on any other website. Just enter in explosives, and it will teach you how to make everything from pipe bombs to even nuclear weapons.
If we were to have a renewable energy economy, that would dramatically reduce our dependence on oil, and that would diminish our exposure to the political volatility in the Middle East.
And what do you have? Texas businessmen, failed Texas businessmen, just like the one we have in the White House, who've been brought to Iraq to run the ministries.
Says me coming back from the war, I need medical care, I have injuries that needs attention right away, and I have to go through my Senator Kennedy's office to do that.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, August 15th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The largest blackout in U.S. history left more than 4 million people powerless for a second day today. Even when the lights flicked back on, they illuminated a plethora of unsolved problems. The worst water crisis in Ohio history, a state of emergency in Michigan, a paralyzed subway system in New York City. More on that in a moment. In a major boost for the roadmap peace plan, Israel has agreed to hand over an additional 4 West Bank cities to Palestinian control. Palestinian and Israeli officials said today. Israel also announced that it will permit Yasser Arafat to travel to the Gaza Strip to visit the grave of his sister, who died earlier this week and was buried in Gaza City. Israel TV reported today it would be Arafat's first time leaving his besieged compound in Ramallah in more than a year and a half. Embracing loved ones and gulping down whatever food they could find, tens of thousands of hungry people today broke through front lines that divided Liberia's capital for 10 weeks of deadly siege. Guarded by U.S. Marines and West African peacekeepers, the first aid ship docked. Singing gospel songs, women surged over a bridge carpeted with bullet casings and shrapnel after crowds overran razor wire barricades in search of rice, oil, and other goods. And from New York to Michigan and spilling across the border in Ottawa, some 4 million people remained without power for a second day today in the largest blackout in U.S. history. The outage, whose causes are still unknown, spread across 8 states in just 9 seconds. Left New York commuters trapped in subways, Toronto business people trapped in office buildings without functioning elevators, and residents of Cleveland without running water. People around the rest of the world looked on in disbelief as citizens of the world's greatest industrial power woke up this morning with the lights still out. But none of this came as much of a surprise to Lloyd Dumas, professor of political economy at the University of Texas at Dallas and author of Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility and Dangerous Technologies. When we reached him earlier today, he said the events seem eerily familiar.
Like many other people, I wondered if there was a terrorist incident that might have begun the process, but it also created a kind of flashback for me because in 1965, when a similar power blackout occurred that took out the whole northeast United States, I was between stations in a crammed rush hour subway in New York City for 3 hours. It's an experience I won't forget. And, of course, the same problem occurred later in 1977. The interesting thing about it is that both of these situations occurred in a system that was created to try to prevent blackouts from occurring in the first place. Prior to 1965, the power systems in the U.S. began to be connected up. The idea was to create a grid so that if part of the system went out, the rest of the system would just pump more power into the grid, and nobody would really lose electricity. The problem was, in 1965, when part of the system went out, the other parts started to produce more electricity to pump into the system, but they became, some of them were not in very good condition, and they became overloaded. Then they went out. And when they went out, that put more strain on the rest of the system, and it started to go out. So we had a cascading power failure that took out the whole northeast U.S. 1977, something very similar occurred, but it was restricted to New York City. And there was it kicked off a period of arson and looting that led to up to $1 billion worth of property damage. And apparently yesterday, on the 14th of August, something very similar happened. Part of the grid went down, and that created a series of cascading failures that eventually took out the Northeast, part of the Midwest, and part of Canada. It appears, from all the reports that I've heard, that it was not a terrorist incident. But what it does point up is the vulnerability of modern technological systems to disruption. In modern technological society, you don't have to create a disaster in four places by doing things in four places. You can create a problem in one place that transmits the problem to the other places.
I was wondering if perhaps there isn't obviously some vulnerability in our system, but if someone with ill intentions might have actually taken advantage of those weaknesses and performed some sort of terroristic act.
The possibilities exist. I can't say that there's any evidence that this is what happened yesterday. I suppose we'll find out as time goes by. But the possibility certainly exists. Let me point out something to you that I think you might find interesting. If you go back to September 11, 2001, do you remember there was a fourth plane that crashed into the woods, I think it was, in Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the flight path that plane took, it came out of the northeast. It sort of looped around after it was hijacked, headed back toward the east coast, and it crashed when the passengers and crew fought with the hijackers. If you extend the path of that flight, look at the pattern of the flight, and just extend it about another 100, 120 miles, you're right over the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. It's possible, although I can't say for sure, and I don't think anybody can say, it's possible that that was the target, that the target wasn't something else in Washington, but rather the intention was to crash that airliner into the containment building at the Three Mile Island plant. Certainly the most famous, one of the two most famous nuclear power plants in the world. And in Lethal Arrogance, I wrote about the possibility that terrorists might eventually try to hijack a plane and crash it into a power plant. Now, that would have created a disaster of major proportions, perhaps an American Chernobyl.
Mm. You write, Lloyd Duma, that no technological system ever designed is immune to catastrophic failure as a result of human technical error. Can you talk about this in the context of some of the more dangerous technologies we live with, such as the nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction?
Well, if you look at the period from the early 1960s until recent times, let's say even 5 or 10 years ago, there were in the public records more than 89 nuclear weapons accidents. I'm talking about nuclear weapons now, not nuclear power plants. There have been lots of incidents and some more serious accidents with nuclear weapons along the way. There have been failures of the warning systems for America's nuclear systems, nuclear weapons systems. And those warning systems have failed in ways on several occasions that might have led to an accidental war being triggered. We also have had a terrible accident in Bhopal, India, at a Union Carbide chemical plant that killed at least 2,000 people in the city of Bhopal and injured perhaps 100,000 to 200,000 more. We've had Chernobyl, of course. The problem is that all technologies fail from time to time, and most of that we can live with. It causes a problem like this disruption we experienced in the last day or so, but it doesn't cause a major disaster. But there are technologies we're dealing with, like nuclear power, like nuclear weapons, like biological and chemical weapons and industrial toxic chemicals, that have the potential of creating really major disasters. When human error is just too common, and malevolence, including terrorism, is too common for us to continue to have these systems around. We ought to get rid of them and replace them with something that's safer, that gives us more margin.
Mm. We're also joined by Ross Gelbspan, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Heat is On. Ross, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. You've written a lot about the need to turn to renewable sources of energy. Of course, if every building was somewhat self-sufficient and had a solar panel or wind turbine on its roof, the effects of this power outage wouldn't be nearly as dramatic as we're now witnessing. But looking at the Bush administration's energy plans and the recent war in Iraq, which many analysts say was essentially a war for oil, it doesn't look as if anything is on the drawing board other than continued dependence on fossil fuels.
That's completely right, Verna, and it is a very, very short-sighted policy for a number of reasons. And the first, as Professor Duma pointed out, is the vulnerability of grids. And if we had a renewable energy economy with people having home-based fuel cells and solar panels and regional wind farms and so forth, That would make the grid a far less strategic target for terrorists, and it would also eliminate the possibility of mass crashing, as we're seeing. I think there's some other connections with terrorism here also. If we were to have a renewable energy economy, that would dramatically reduce our dependence on oil, and that would diminish our exposure to the political volatility in the Middle East. And if you look at this issue from a climate point of view, the science is unambiguous on one point. Humanity needs in a very short time to stop its use of fossil fuels to cut it by 70% globally. And what that implies is not only a switch in the U.S. to a renewable energy economy, but a switch in India and China and Mexico and Nigeria and all the developing countries that are struggling to stay ahead of poverty. And were the U.S. to spearhead that kind of a transition, since energy-related jobs create far more wealth than jobs in any other sector, that would do more than anything else in the long term, I think, to undermine anti-U.S. sentiment that gives rise to this threat of terrorism, which, as Professor Dumas said, was the first thing we all thought about after yesterday's power crash. So I think that's very important. And if you look at what the Bush administration has done in contrast to that need, essentially the White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal. The president began by reneging on his campaign promise to cap emissions from power plants. He then came out with his energy plan, which calls for 1,300 to 1,900 new power plants. And from a climate point of view, that's basically a fast track to climate hell. He then withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol on the grounds that it exempts the developing countries from the first round of cuts. And what's really striking is what's going on in the rest of the world. Holland has just finished a plan to cut their emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed the United Kingdom to cut 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to 50% cuts in 50 years. So what we're seeing here in the White House, I think, basically is essentially corruption disguised as political conservatism.
Well, Ross Gelspan, while this blackout is taking place, another news story making the headlines is the ongoing extreme weather conditions around the world. The East Coast and parts of the Arab world experienced their worst snowstorm in several decades this past winter. Large chunks of the Antarctic ice shelf continue to break off and melt at record numbers, and CNN is reporting that as many as 3,000 people have died in France over the past several weeks as a result of the heat wave. How much scientific evidence is there that these are all effects of global warming? And how much evidence is there that the burning of fossil fuels is the primary cause of this?
It is accepted and has been really since 1995 that fossil fuels are what are trapping in heat, the emissions from fossil fuels. This is contributing to the warming of the planet. And these findings come from more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries who are reporting to the UN in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. And the first sort of earmark of early-stage global warming are these extreme weather events. There was a report out last month by the United Nations, the World Meteorological Organization, who said these weather extremes will only continue to become more severe. So that, as you mentioned, this year alone, in 2003, we've seen 1,400 people die from a heat wave in India and Pakistan. The U.S. in the month of May experienced 562 tornadoes, which is a record. This heat wave in Europe set a new temperature record in Britain. It's triggered the worst forest fires in memory in Portugal, and as you mentioned, killed up to 3,000 people in France. There's a relentless succession of these extreme weather events, and it is absolutely a consequence of the warming of the atmosphere, and that is directly related to our fossil fuel burning.
But, of course, it's a lot easier said than done to be able to switch to more efficient and renewable sources of energy to power the world. What would you do, for example, to address this in terms of the world's economy?
Well, I think the real misconception here is that it would be very costly. And I think the real truth is, were we to do this in a wholesale, mass way, it would be extremely expansive of the global economy and create a huge amount of wealth. The U.S. spends about $25 billion a year subsidizing coal and oil. The industrial world spends about $200 billion subsidizing fossil fuels. We're saying take that money away from fossil fuels, put it behind renewable energy. The oil companies will follow the money, and they will use that money to retool and retrain their workers to make windmills and solar panels and fuel cells and so forth. And you need some of this money to retrain the country's coal miners, but that's still more than enough for the intended purpose.
So for the sake of our listeners who may not understand exactly what you mean, what would that look like, switching from fossil fuels to renewable energy options?
What it means, what it would mean is that most homes would have either a hydrogen fuel cell in their basement or a solar panel photovoltaic on their roof. So each home would become its own electricity generator. There would be no need or very little need for some large coal-fired power plants, and you would essentially have a much more dispersed and decentralized kind of energy system.
And that would have us as a society less dependent on these fossil fuels. And so, Professor Duma, I guess that would in turn put less pressure on our energy systems and infrastructure in this country.
Yes, I have to say I agree with virtually everything that Ross just said. In fact, it wouldn't be that expensive to do. We are spending huge amounts of money and have for a long time subsidizing fossil fuels and nuclear power. In fact, if we hadn't subsidized nuclear power so massively, we wouldn't even have nuclear power. Mm-hmm. It would never have developed or been deployed as a technology. And, in fact, this is a path, the kind of path that Russ is talking about, is a path to reducing both the kinds of dangers of failure that I was talking about earlier and the ecological damage we're doing to ourselves, which is indisputable. If we had no alternative, that is, if we either had modern society or we had to go back to the cave world, if we didn't face these risks, then we might decide, well, we have to do it anyway. But the fact is, there are all kinds of alternatives, and they make economic sense. I'm an economist. I can tell you that's true. But we have to get our heads out of the way we've been thinking about it, and we have to be ready to use our resources to put ourselves on a path that's ecologically healthier, and in terms of security, is healthier for us as well. And that is perfectly doable.
Okay. Any final thoughts on either of your parts?
Nobody is suggesting we sit in the dark and ride bicycles. The technology exists for us all to make this transition to a much more certainly environmentally friendly and I think a wealthier and more peaceful world. But I think what is needed to be understood by bottom is we are facing a huge conflict of interest, and the fossil fuel industry is the largest commercial enterprise on the planet. And so this really requires very strong political action. And if that were to happen, clearly the technology, the economic models, and the proper social structures have long since been thought out and are waiting to be implemented.
That's absolutely true. This is not a problem of technology. This is a problem of political will. We've had all the warnings we need. We've had all the messages we can get. We need to act on these now. We need to develop the political will to take us to a safer and ecologically healthier path. We can do it, and we should do it, and we should start now.
Lloyd Duma is a professor of political economy at the University of Texas at Dallas and the author of Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility, and Dangerous Technologies. Ross Gelbspan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Heat Is On. Among the people of the world to sympathize with Americans and Canadians who are still without power are the residents of Iraq, whose electricity is still sporadic, 100 days after the U.S. occupation of their country began. As they live in 120-degree heat without the luxury of fans or air conditioners, they've developed advanced techniques to adapt. Some said it was a poetic justice of sorts that Americans are now suffering the same fate, albeit briefly. Speaking with a reporter from the Associated Press, Iraqis offered this list of the top 10 ways to cope without electricity.
Number 10, sleep on a roof without power, and hence without air conditioning.
Iraqis have taken to climbing upstairs in the hot nights. Some install metal bed frames on rooftops, while others simply stretch out on thin mattresses. Quote, "We sleep on the roof," said Hadia Zaidan Khalif, 38, wearing a black head-to-toe abaya in the hot sun. It's cooler there.
Number 9, sit in the shade. Many Iraqis go outside when the power is off.
"We sit in the shade," said George Vued, 27, playing cards with friends on the sidewalk. Of the U.S. blackout, he said, "I hope it lasts for 20 years. Let them feel our suffering.
Number 8. Head for the water.
We go to the river, just like in the old days, said Saleh Muayyad, 53. Several people said they had seen American beaches on television and suggested they might be a good place to sit out the blackout. They have so many beautiful beaches, said Hamid Khalil, 44. They should go where it's not so hot.
Number 6. Buy blocks of ice.
When refrigerators shut down, there is no better way to keep food cool. Muhammad Abdul Zahara, 24, sells about 20 a day from a roadside table. When it's hot, people buy a lot of ice, he said.
Number 5. Check for bitter enders.
They should go to the power station and see what the problem is, suggested Ahmed Abdul Hassan. Maybe they are followers of Saddam Hussein who are sabotaging their power stations. That's what happens here.
Number 4. Get a generator.
Abbas Abdul Alamir, 53, has one of a long row of shops selling generators in Baghdad's Karada shopping street. When the power goes out, sales go up. I sell about 30 generators a day, he said. When the shutdown lasts, I can sell even more.
Number 3. Call in the Iraqis.
Some suggested the Americans ask the Iraqis how to get the power going again. Let them take experts from Iraq, said Alla Hussein, 32, waiting in a long line for gas because there was no electricity for the pumps. Our experts have a lot of experience in these matters.
Number 2. Use foul language.
When the power goes out, I curse everybody, said Ahmad Halawi, a 63-year-old accountant. I curse God, I curse Saddam Hussein, and I curse the Americans.
And the number one suggestion among Iraqis for Americans suffering without power? Take to the streets.
Some said demonstrations can be effective in persuading authorities to turn the switch.
We held protests. After that, we had fewer blackouts.
Ahmad Abdul Hussein said without even a hint of sarcasm.
I'd suggest Americans go out and demonstrate.
Tips from Iraqis to Americans about living without power. They were collected by AP reporter Nico Price and performed by the staff of Pacifica Station WPFW here in the nation's capital and produced by radio dramatist Anthony Sloan. When the blackout first occurred, one of the early theories was that it was caused by a fast-spreading computer worm, a virus-like program that has wreaked havoc on computer systems around the world in recent weeks. Though that possibility has since been ruled out by experts, the suggestion that it might have been the case raised the issue that terrorism in the 21st century may take more non-traditional forms, attacking the economic and technological infrastructure that runs the country. But increasingly, in the world of cyberspace, computer enthusiasts, those with the curiosity to find out how copyrighted computer code works, and people who simply want to use the Internet as a source for free speech and free expression are being branded economic terrorists and criminals. Take the case of Sherman Austin, the 18-year-old webmaster of RaiseTheFist.com, who was recently sentenced to 1 year in federal prison with 3 years of probation. The judge shocked the courtroom when he went against the recommendation of the prosecution, the FBI, and the Justice Department, who had only asked that Austin be sentenced to only 4 months in a halfway house with 3 years of probation. Sonali Kalhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK spoke with Sherman Austin and his mother, Jennifer Martin, regarding his recent sentence.
Well, nonetheless, not surprised, pretty much based on, because of what the judge said last time. I mean, he pretty much turned the whole case into nothing but, you know, his own personal politics and what he wanted to do to make his own political example for, in what he says, quote-unquote, future revolutionaries.
And it's interesting because, of course, last time when we left this story, we were surprised by the fact that the judge was going to be seeking a recommendation from the FBI about what your sentence should be. And the FBI only suggested 4 months in a halfway house. The judge overruled that, went for an entire year. Jennifer, what was your reaction to hearing this? Why do you think he did it?
First of all, the prosecutor, the FBI, and the Justice Department, as well as Sherman's lawyer, all recommended 4 months in prison and 4 months in a halfway house. I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew that. And as far as I'm concerned, my question is, what happened to the punishment fitting the crime, if indeed there even was a crime? And this case is an inexcusable waste of taxpayers' money. And my son, who's an African-American male, I feel was railroaded by the system. And I question how anyone could possibly consider the judges tripling the prosecution's recommended sentence as judicial wisdom and fair interpretation of the law to fit the act. It was obvious that Judge Wilson had an agenda, and it was obvious throughout this case to me that had I had the funds to hire a private attorney, my son would not be facing 12 months in prison, if he would be facing prison at all. And the defense in this case was not willing to challenge the system, and the system needed to be challenged. I'm not shocked. I am saddened. This exemplifies the inconsistencies in our justice system, where there's only justice for the rich.
Remind our listeners again what the charge was.
The charge was posting with intent. Posting is not considered illegal. However, posting with intent, the intent that the information be used to commit acts of violence, is illegal under U.S. Code 18. I don't know all the little numeric classifications for the law. And I felt like my family was put in a vice grip, my son and my entire family. And the prosecutor and the federal public defender and everybody involved were tightening the screws every time we asked questions, every time Sherman resisted the plea. The plea started out with 1 month in prison, and in a year and a half time, you know, it kept changing and changing and changing. Sometimes we didn't even know it was going to change, or at least I didn't, until I received notification in the mail. And then they came down with the possibility of a terrorist enhancement every time Sherman said, well, I don't want to sign the plea, or I want this taken out. And this was based on a case in the Court of Appeals with the United States versus Graham, in which case this guy Graham was a member of a militia group who advocated violence against the government and was found with marijuana plants, ammunition, machine guns, articles and books relating to blowing up and harming people in his house. Where's the analogy here? How does this case relate any way to Sherman, a nonviolent 18-year-old kid who posted a guide on his website and did not own any weapons of any kind, nor did he ever commit any act of violence? And these types of analogies were used throughout this case to justify the harsh treatment of my son. You know, Judge Wilson thinks he's going to send a message. Well, Judge Wilson has just created another activist, me, Mom, because I see clearly the inconsistencies in our system, and I am committed and willing to stand up and speak out about it. They told us to be quiet, to be silent throughout this whole thing, because then he would get a lighter sentence. They railroaded my son, and that's exactly the way I feel about it.
Now, it's interesting because, of course, what was posted on your website, Sherman, were instructions, bomb-making instructions, which, of course, one can walk into a bookstore or a library and find those as well. Is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you can find these type of instructions. I mean, you can find 10 times more information on any other website, like Amazon.com or even going to HowThingsWork.com and just enter in explosives, and it will teach you how to make everything from pipe bombs to even nuclear weapons. I mean, if someone were interested in actually creating explosives, I don't think they would have to rely on RaiseTheFist.com to get any type of bomb-making information. I mean, that type of information is readily available on so many other websites, thousands of other websites, not just websites like Amazon.com, but other, you know, neo-Nazi websites which cover everything from assassinations to explosives, frauds, firearms. It's not surprising because, I mean, distribution of information related to explosives is not illegal. What the illegal part is the intent part.
The intent. Mm-hmm.
And what they have to prove is that you have intent. And it's almost like thought crime because the way they prove it, it's like I think Bush made it clear when he said you're either with me or against me. I mean, you have intent if you disagree with the current political system in this country right now. I mean, that's just enough for them to say, okay, you have intent. But yet you can be a neo-Nazi, you know, advocating, you know, the extermination of all the races, and, you know, you don't have intent. You can be someone who's part of a right-wing militia advocating, you know, the extermination of any other political group, and you don't have intent. You can be an anarchist, and, you know, you post one small little thing that doesn't even compare to what else is out there on the Internet, what else you can find there in any library, and you know, you automatically have intent. So I think the intent part is just you have intent when, you know, Bush said you're either with me or against me.
Austin, Sherman Austin, what about the kind of stipulations that went along with your probation once you are out of prison? The next 3 years, what can you not do?
Basically, they're trying to say that, number one, I can't use a computer for any political purposes. I can only use it to do work for a job, and that even we have to you know, fight for, because basically in the pre-sentencing report and in the plea, they say they don't want me using a computer at all, but they're supposed to let you use it if it's work-related. They also said that I can't associate with anyone who espouses the violent overthrow of any government, and I can't work with or associate with any anarchists or any political groups or any progressive groups. And, I mean, the part about anyone who espouses violence, how do they determine that? How can they say that this person here or this group here uses violence, you can't associate with them, you're violating the conditions of your probation, we want to give you another 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years? I mean, to me, it has nothing to do with the actual crime. They're just using this, and they're just putting together this whole intense 3 years of probation to try and limit my activism and my you know, work within the community, not just offline, but, you know, on the internet. They want to limit, you know, the way I can work with Raise the Fist and the way I can work with other things online, you know, to basically get messages out. And basically, I mean, the whole thing is just basically outrageous. I mean, there's no real word you can use to describe it.
Sherman Austin, the webmaster of RaiseTheFist.com, who recently was sentenced to 1 year in federal prison with 3 years of probation. Thanks to Fidel Rodriguez for production assistance with that piece. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. We'll be back in a moment.